You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
During the last 6 weeks, you heard the special programming of our winter fundraising drive. Thank you for supporting Volume 2 of the All Thrills, No Frills campaign. KBOO is on course to exceed our goal of $17,000 as the final checks come through the mail. If you haven't already, get your limited edition Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. Please go to kboo.fm/bgshirt. This design was created by a volunteer creator from Music from the True Vine, which airs every Saturday at 9 a.m. Don't wait. Get yours now. Go to kboo.fm/bgshirt. Again, thank you for supporting your community radio, KBOO FM.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel. I'm here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Stephen.
Good to have you back. Both of us are public school teachers, and we host every second Monday of the month, where typically we interview educators and we talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today, we have Tony Salm and Misha Fliger. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Well, we always like to start by hearing a little bit about just your background as educators. I think a lot of that is because oftentimes anti-union folks try to separate out union leaders from workers, from educators in this case. And so would you just talk about how you became an educator and what your current position is?
Well, I became an educator about 32 years ago, and it's a very long story, actually. I was overseas, Central America, ended up teaching in international schools, three different international schools in Guatemala and Ecuador and Spain, ended up in Oregon around 2000, and have stayed an educator ever since then. I've taught in elementary schools at various grade levels from grades 1 through 5. I'm in Woodburn right now. Right now I'm a first grade Spanish bilingual teacher in Heritage Elementary School in Woodburn.
Great. And how about you, Misha?
This is my fourth year teaching. I was a pretty bad student growing up. As an elementary school kid, as a middle school kid, I got into a lot of trouble and didn't get very good grades. I did not like school at all. And I had a number of teachers who I really liked throughout my time as a student. And I kind of, you know, decided that I would want to be a teacher for the sole purpose of, you know, being someone who was available to other kids who also didn't like school, understood that perspective. And so I 4 years ago, I finished my graduate teaching program at U of O, and I was offered a position at Success Alternative School in Woodburn. So I work at the Alternative School in Woodburn with a great, great staff there. And we work with some amazing kids who are just some of the best students I've ever met. A lot of them are parents. A lot of them struggle with the material conditions of their life. And despite all that, they're able to come to school and really commit themselves to learning. And they're very respectful and they're just great kids. So, you know, that's kind of my pathway in education, more from the, you know, the other end of things, you know, not really liking school.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I think that's interesting. I find that that's often the case, is that educators go into it either because they really love their experience and they want to continue to have that kind of experience on the other end of things, or they really didn't enjoy their experience and they want to change things. And I think, you know, both of those scenarios can, of course, lead to a great teacher. So in addition to your work as educators, you are now union leaders. Talk about how that came about for you. It's always nice, I think, for listeners to hear about because obviously, all right, maybe I shouldn't say obviously, but most educators don't start out their first year all gung-ho about unions. A lot of them haven't really even heard about union much. So how did that come about for you?
Well, I had some really good role models in my first teaching assignment in Woodburn at Washington Elementary School. The president of the union at the time, his name was Tom Maravilla, and he was a real, you know, he had a real presence, and I just admired the way he advocated for teachers, for educators, and you know, and brought forth any kinds of issues or grievances, or you know, in a really diplomatic and forceful way. So you know, I've been a building rep, you know, representing members with various issues for 15 or so years, and just sort of slowly, as the process continued, I've gone to the RA, the Representative Assembly, for OEA, I don't know, for maybe 10 or 15 years. And, you know, there was an opportunity to become vice president of the union several years ago. And so I've just been, you know, just kind of, I guess, moving up. And I'm president now. It's because the previous president had to resign. But I'm in it now as president, and we are building toward a strike. So it's been a long process of union work and continuing it, you know, I'm really proud of my colleagues, our members, fellow educators who are standing up for educators in general.
Yeah, my path to unionship is kind of a long one. I loved history as a kid, and you know, anyone who is a student of history, you know, you eventually will come across certain texts. And you know, I discovered Howard Zinn at the age of 16, and I became enraptured in all these labor heroes: Emiliano Zapata, Eugene Debs, Elizabeth Gurney Flynn, you know, Rosa Luxemburg, and I kind of just became like really enraptured by all these, you know, people who I felt were like fighting this amazing, you know, historical, world-shaking struggle. And so I kind of already knew about these sort of things, you know, the Wobblies, the IWW, and you know, all the labor unrest of the early 20th century in the United States. And so I kind of was sort of pre-primed for union stuff as I got older and did my first series of menial jobs working in food service, you know, being absolutely demeaned by my bosses and by certain customers, and you know, the entire time thinking, you know, how wonderful would it be if there's any semblance of democracy in our workplace like there is in our ostensibly in our politics. So by the time I became a teacher, I was excited to be in a union. And you know, when the first people from Eugene 4J, Eugene Education Association, came in and talked to us, I was stoked. And then I got really lucky because, you know, Woodburn's a small town, but I was there for maybe 2 years and I was already being recruited by some really wonderful militant people. Tony Salm, and obviously, and Kathy Kufton in particular, she saw me in a couple of Zoom meetings and she just really roped me in. She was just, you know, started asking me to participate and do things. And I was just really inspired by all the really hard organizing work that people were doing. And it wasn't just, you know, for teachers, but you know, people were reaching out to communities, and people like Tony and Kathy have done just such an amazing job of really just, you know, reaching out to everyone in the community. So that it's not just the union, you know, oriented towards teachers, but it's a union sort of oriented for the good of everyone. And, you know, for a town this size and for a district this size, you know, I feel like our union has like such a great core of really experienced leadership and motivated people, you know, especially in a time where we're really coming out of an era of labor apathy, especially amongst, you know, teacher unions who, you know, in the last 20 to 30 years, you know, haven't really been agitating or moving in a way that, you know, was representative of history of unions. So I feel really, really lucky to be a fourth year teacher in such a wonderful union with so many wonderful people who have really taught me a lot about what it means to organize and taught me what it means to be in a union.
Thank you both for sharing that. I love hearing people's path to union action. And I can really, Misha, relate to a lot of parts of your story in the path to teaching. I have a similar perspective. So we invited you on the show because Woodburn Education Association are preparing for the very real possibility of going on strike later this month. Would you start by telling our listeners about the Woodburn community? What are the strengths and issues in the community and the schools as well?
Well, Woodburn is unique, and I think that's one of the reasons both Misha and I, both love teaching there. It is multicultural, multilingual. We have a majority in the community is Spanish speaking. We also have a Russian speaking community, and our school district is trilingual. We have dual language programs in Russian and English and Spanish and English, and it's unique in so many ways, not just in terms of the educational program for students, but the community itself and the families that we work with. It is a high need, high poverty area, and so working with families is not the same. It's not the same approach that you would use in other communities. Many families are really struggling to feed their families or are living in very large families living in small, in small spaces or even sharing spaces. So we have been really reaching out to meet with community members and talk about, for example, preserving and enhancing our dual language program, which is about 25 years old. But one of the issues we've been talking about in bargaining and to the public is that we have not, as a district, has not really nurtured the program, not really invested in it in recent years. It's still very strong, especially in elementary school, but it kind of tails off in middle and high schools, although the district does tout itself as this pioneering dual language district, which it is. There's no doubt about that, but it has not been really invested in and trained for, especially for new staff in recent years. So, we love working in this community. We love our students. And we believe we have significant support from the families of our students who support their teachers.
Yeah. I mean, I want to second everything Tony said. I mean, it's probably one of the most unique and special districts to work in the entire state. And, I didn't know much about it coming in, except for what I'd learned about the dual language program when I was in university, and it's a well-regarded and well-known program. And I remember my instructors at University of Oregon in the graduate teaching program talking about Woodburn and its dual language program and how amazing it was. These outcomes that you see for students, who are Spanish speakers or Russian speakers, and then they also they retain their native language, but they also learn English and they become more proficient in both than they would ever be in any sort of run-of-the-mill ESOL, program. And so I was just really excited to be a part of that. And as I, started teaching in the community, I started also realizing how special the community is, in an age of sort of increasing tension between teachers and, and some communities, certain elements of, our society have really started antagonizing against teachers, the recent, polemics about teachers, pushing CRT or teachers as groomers. And we're incredibly lucky because that isn't something we've encountered. We've actually have such a really strong and healthy relationship with the parents and the communities that we serve. It's this sort of bilateral relationship where, we do our best to serve them and they in return give respect and support to us in unimaginable ways. And so we're just super lucky to be part of this community, and we're, to have these people who support us so much. The greatest honor of my career, wasn't, being part, you know, wasn't becoming a teacher, but like, you know, having a student come to me, you know, one day and say, hey, you know, Misha, you're now an honorary Mexican, you know, that's something for me that I was like, felt like this is such an inclusive and meaningful community that I would want to do anything in my power to ensure that we can, that these kids can continue to have the best education possible and that we can continue to honor and preserve their culture and their language. And I, you know, I think everything we're doing as a union right now is an effort to do that, to preserve this wonderful community and their language and their culture.
That's been long enough to have former students, former elementary students of mine as colleagues, as teaching colleagues. And, you know, I'm very proud of them, of course.
Nice. Yeah, so that leads to our next question, which is, you know, the bargaining, it's been going on for a while. You've been negotiating with the district for a while now. What are the primary things that you're fighting for? What are the primary sticking points where the district is pushing back?
Well, I do want to start by celebrating one of our successes, which is getting a dual language article in our contract. And from as far as I know, we are the first district in the entire state to have an entire article dedicated to enshrining dual language in our contract, which ensures that there'll be proper supervision and maintenance of the dual language program moving forward. And that was hard fought. And, you know, we really pushed on it for a long time, Tony. And some of our other peers in the bargaining team put a lot of work into crafting that article, and it was hard fought, and we got some help from some outside influence as well as some inside influence. You know, parents really pressured the district to include that article. They were showing up for open bargaining meets. You know, almost every time we had bargaining, there'd be parents there, and a lot of the times they outnumbered the teachers who were in attendance, and so it just shows how important that piece to it is as well. The other issues that we're fighting, or the most important one right now, is classroom size. And so for those of who are aware, there's a law in Oregon, SB 580, which basically makes it so that any title, that classroom size is a mandatory subject of bargaining for any Title I schools. Woodburn is the only school district in the entire state where every single school in the district is Title I, which means we're the only Title I district in the entire state. So this is a mandatory piece of bargaining for us. And so we're making an effort to be cognizant of the material restrictions of you know, our district, but also trying to make classroom size caps in places where it'll have the most effect. And that'll be in the K-3 range, and then also in special education. So we're trying to make caseload caps for special educators, because we think that having caps in those places, we will see the best outcomes, while also being cognizant that, you know, it might not be feasible economically for our district to have it across all grade levels. But we're hoping that getting that foot in the door, right, will lead to, you know, downstream effects. As those students come out of K-3, they'll be better served in smaller classroom sizes, more individual attention, and they'll be able to, you know, we'll see the effects up in through the secondary level. We understand that the district has been pretty intransigent about it. They've really only offered us a committee on classroom size, which we think is, you know, it's not particularly useful. I know a lot, like, I make this joke all the time, but like, we've all been on committees and their efficacy varies wildly, to say the very least.
Yes, indeed.
So, we think that it, you know, we are a Title I district, and that, you know, we should really be leading the charge, and, you know, the one silver bullet that we as educators know actually works in education, which is smaller classroom sizes. And I don't want to belabor this point, but I work in alternative ed, and I, you know, at Success, we have small classroom sizes. You know, I don't exceed classroom sizes of 17 regularly. So we have small classroom sizes, and all of our kids will vouch, I love Success so much more than the main campus of high school for that exact reason, because the classrooms are smaller. My teacher knows my name. They say hi to me. They know what my strengths are. They know where I need help in, and they know how I need to be accommodated. And so we see much better outcomes for our kids at Success because of that reason. You know, the material and the content isn't any easier. We're still aligning to standards, but because of that individualized attention, kids who say, I was never good at math, suddenly we have an amazing math teacher, Eric Van Bergen, and all of a sudden these kids are math pros. You know, kids will say, I never liked reading. I never liked science. or any of these subjects, and now they say, I get it. So we all know how beneficial smaller classroom sizes are, especially for vulnerable populations like bilingual students, like students who come from, you know, backgrounds of material deprivation. And so we're saying it's the district should be cognizant that how effective smaller classroom sizes are, and they should really be taking the mantle and working with us to ensure that, you know, we can utilize this tool to ensure better outcomes for our students. So that's the one thing we want to press on, is like classroom size is the biggest thing that we want to focus on, because we think it's the most important thing for our students and for the community. And we also recognize that, you know, as we get our foot in the door to get classroom caps in our contract, that will allow other school districts and other bargains and other unions to, you know, use us as a precedent and say, hey, they got classroom size, you know, how about we get that in our contract, so that we can open the door for unions all over the state to start talking about classroom size in their CBA in a meaningful way with caps, right? The other piece, of course, is a cost of living adjustment. You know, everyone's felt the effects of inflation. And we think that, you know, teachers already are, you know, well known for being underpaid, you know. I mean, at this point, almost everyone's underpaid, you know, all workers are underpaid at this point, but teachers with their level of skill and expertise, you know, they most of them are highly educated. All of them are highly educated. All teachers are highly skilled, but this is especially so in Woodburn. And most teach a huge amount of our teachers are bilingual. All of our teachers are culturally responsive, meaning they understand the culture of their students, and the content that they teach reflects that. And they also know what's important to our students, you know, from a cultural level. And these are skills that have to be developed over years and years and years. And so these kind of skills, you can't just find anywhere. You know, you have to find really special, really gifted, really talented teachers to do that. And the issue that we had in Woodburn is that we're finding these teachers, right? But then we're losing them, right? I started calling it, you know, the school of Woodburn, where we'll get teachers and we'll give them the best dual language education possible. Well, they'll teach in a dual language classroom for 2 or 3 years. And then they'll be poached by districts like Beaverton, West Lynn, Hillsborough, Portland, who've developed their own dual language programs, which are, you know, modeled after our own Woodburn program, but then pulling them away with higher pay. A Woodburn teacher will cap out around $82,000 without the differentials, but, you know, Beaverton, they cap out around $101,000 for educators at 18 years. And so the issue is that we're going to be losing, you know, without proper incentive, without proper pay that reflects the skills of our teachers, we're going to start losing them to districts who are starting to understand the value of dual language teachers. And teachers themselves will be doing the economic calculus of, you know, can I afford to stay in Woodburn, right? If I have a family to care about, if I'm trying to develop a career, if I'm trying to start a family, right? I'm sitting right now in my parents' house because between my student loans and between my other payments and my fiance, who's currently finishing college, I can't afford to move out and to start my own life. You know, I'm almost 30. And for me, you know, I would be start thinking about, you know, what would I need to do to ensure that, you know, I can actually have a life, you know, that's you know, meaningful to me outside of work. And so those are the concerns that we're really trying to address as part of this bargain. Tony, I don't know if you want to add anything. Sorry, I talked for a while there.
Yeah, I would add that from what the district is offering us now in their latest offer, it really doesn't make up for the rate of inflation since the last contract that was, you know, signed 3 years ago. And you know, we also looked at the pay scale of district administrators, and just doing the math with Misha's help and you know, just with our team sort of analyzing the numbers, we noticed that some of the administrators gave themselves 16% raise over just 1 year, and their best offer to us is right now, what is it, 14% over 3 years, is that correct?
12%
over 3 years. So, you know, we look at that contrast, administrators versus teachers, and what, you know, we are the ones that are on the front lines with the students, and just noticing that contrast, and that is certainly woken up our membership.
Yeah, and quickly on that point, you know, when we asked them, you know, what was the rationale between this close to 16% raise, you know, $20,000 raise that many of the director level positions at the district office received, and they said retention, you know, that other school districts, you know, pay their administrators at this rate, and we want to ensure that, you know, we're retaining that we're, you know, these people. And we said we agree that retention is important, and we'd like to see the same consideration extended to us. And then also, of course, you know, we're all cognizant of inflation, you know, on the West Coast in our particular area, it's been about 14% over the last 2 years. So taking a 12% raise that over the next 3 years, not even factoring in the rates of inflation for the next 2 years, would constitute a 2% pay cut. We would be basically we would be earning 2% less than we did 3 years ago because our dollars aren't going as far. We're asking for 19.5%, not only to basically ameliorate the effects of inflation, but also to reflect the, you know, the highly talented pool of educators that we have here at Woodburn, you know, that we think our pay should reflect that.
Yeah, the 19.5 is over 3 years.
Right? Over 3 years, right. So it's going to be for this year and the next 2 years as well, since the school year is almost over. You know, we haven't seen any raise in our income because of the bargain.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I'm just realizing that time is flying by and we only have just a very short amount of time left. Do you want to quickly tell us some about what you've been doing to get your members excited and rallied and prepared for a strike?
Yeah, we have a number of rallies coming up. You know, we just had our strike vote on this past Monday. We had 92% of our membership vote yes on authorizing the strike. So our membership is ready, willing, and able to walk out for a better school for our students. We're going to have a rally on Tuesday during the school board work session, just so that we can let, you know, with the community members and our teachers, we're trying to get a big turnout and capture that same momentum we got from the strike vote and capture the momentum eagerness of our membership. And so we can go out and show the school board, hey, listen, we're serious about creating a better school for our students and for our community, and we want your support on that. You know, we've had this issue where the school board has been kind of at an arm's length throughout these bargains, which is sort of a new development. We have another rally on our last mediation session before our strike. That's going to be on the 19th. That's it. We're just trying to basically have the community and our membership come out in force to show them that, you know, listen, we're not striking yet, but we can come out in force and show you how serious we are. And we're hoping that that show of solidarity and that show of unity will, you know, let the district know that we're, you know, they should know by now how serious we are, but that would be their this is your last chance to work together with us and create a contract that will continue to support our community and our students and, you know, ensure that we are able to keep our good teachers and keep our wonderful, you know, students well-educated. And then our strikes on the 24th. So those are the two major actions we're planning. We're also planning some sort of smaller actions, you know, just to, you know, talk to members and, you know, talk about their concerns over the strike and talk about what our goals are, you know, specifically asking members that, hey, classroom size is a big thing because it might not affect all of us right now, but this is important for our district as well as all educators in the state as a whole.
I would add that none of this would have been possible without many people in our membership and in our union stepping up mm-hmm. in each building to speak to members, you know, face to face. You know, I, of course, and my vice president and the area reps and, you know, just people that are, you know, too numerous to name. You know, this could not be done by, you know, just me and Misha, or just, you know, two or three people. This is, I think, a leadership model that really spreads out the tasks because it's a lot of work to organize everybody. You know, my focus has been on the weekly communication, bargaining updates, just trying to keep people informed about what is being offered by the district, what we are offering, we are proposing, and the rationale, you know, for those things. And through that, and, you know, to getting everybody, you know, attuned to what's going on, I think we've built to this point where, you know, we had, you know, we had everybody but five members voted on this strike authorization, and many of them were in person. And to me, it was just, it was heartwarming just to see the physical presence of people standing in solidarity. You know, we do use Zoom a lot, and it's a very convenient way to get a lot of people together. But, you know, just seeing people willing to show up and express their voice of solidarity, you know, couldn't have been done without numerous people, you know, stepping up and organizing. You know, I also wanted to mention, we've been, you know, having regular interviews with Spanish language radio and other news outlets. You know, we're trying to get out the message, not just to our members, but to families and to the larger community in the Willamette Valley.
Well, I want to thank you both. I'm sorry I have to end it here. We could probably talk for another half hour or so. We had a lot of questions to ask, but we really appreciate you updating us about what's going on in Woodburn and letting people know about the rallies and ways that they can come out and support you. So thank you for joining us on KBOO. Thanks to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio-ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes.